It is kind of funny. Last week we were sitting back there. Jay asked me, he said, what happened? Did you get hit in the head with a rock or something? And I said, I think I must have. But anyway, it is a privilege to be able to stand up and talk to y'all. And it is somewhat nerve-wracking, not because of y'all, but because of what I'm actually doing. I couldn't think of a better group of people that if I'm going to have to stand in front of somebody and talk, this is a great thing. As Eric said, I did teach I think it was like a 65 and above men's class, and I was 35 at the time. But it's like I told Jay last week, I was following a guy that only had a fifth grade education, not two guys like Dr. Graham and Dr. Bryant. So, and it was how this came about, other than me speaking with Eric, was back at the end of January, I get an email from Dr. Graham, and it says, I need to speak to you concerning a Sunday school issue. So anyway, I'm thinking, my mind starts, I try not to scheme and plan, but it's hard for me, especially from the fire department point of view and some of you others that know how it is, try to plan stuff out. I'm thinking, okay, well, what's he trying to say to us? He's fixing to quit teaching. It's just this ominous, ever-looming word, interim, that's behind his name that keeps haunting me every time I come in and open the bulletin. So I'm thinking he's going to say, well, don't say anything about me being the teacher when you're talking to these people because I don't know that I'm going to be here. So anyway, when he finally calls, and he calls me back, let me see, actually, it was February the 5th, 2015 at 8:30 p.m. I remember it like it was yesterday. And he said, hey, I want to talk to you about something. And I said, sure, what? He said, do you mind teaching the Sunday school class? And I was so shocked that he wasn't doing the other things that I wanted to do. I said, yeah, no problem. And last week we were talking, I said, if you'd asked me to jump out the window, I said, I probably would have done that. So he brought back his little being on the hook when he was in the seminary, you know, defending his dissertation. So anyway, here we are. He said, you know, you can continue on in John if you would like to. And I'm thinking, that's exactly what I would like to do, is just somewhere in the middle of where you left off. So anyway, I said, no. I said, really what I'd rather do is, if you could think of something for me to teach that might help get us somewhere and not interrupt what you're teaching the next time around. So anyway, he gave me a couple of verses, and it's going to come out of Exodus 33:19-23, and Exodus 34:1-4. When I first got it, I thought, well, this is going to be pretty simple because, or at least a lot of information, there'll be a lot of information on it because of who it's dealing with, Moses. So anyway, I thought, well, at least I can find a lot of stuff and maybe fill up some time. Had to not necessarily struggle to find a lot of it, but there wasn't as much as I had hoped there would be. But anyway, we'll try to do the best we can with what we've got. I'll read it all out, and then probably what I'll try to do, if it's okay with you, I'm going to go back verse by verse and just point out some things that stood out in my mind. As we're going through this, so Dr. Graham, he wanted us to actually focus on the words, and I'll get to that in a little bit, too. That kind of struck me as strange. But it says, it came about as soon as Moses came near the camp, that he saw, let me put my glasses on. This is one of those days that they're not going good. It came about as soon as Moses came near the camp that he saw the calf and the dancing. Excuse me, I'm on the wrong verse. And he said, I myself will make all my goodness pass before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show compassion on whom I will show compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, nor for me, no man can see me and live. Then the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock. And it will come about when my glory is passing by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with a hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Now the Lord said to Moses, cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered. So be ready by morning, and come up in mourning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on top of the mountain. No man is to come up with you, nor let any man be seen anywhere on the mountain. Even the flocks and the herds may not graze in front of that mountain. So he cut out two stone tablets like the former ones, and Moses rose up early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him. And he took the two stone tablets in his hands. Okay, when he said concentrate on the words and wording, to me it kind of sounded, I mean, we were standing over there, and he was real, you know how you can be very somewhat intimidating to a certain extent. And so I'm thinking, focus on the wording. So anyway, as I was thinking about this past week, I thought, you know, the wording, well, and then I started thinking about how words in our time don't mean as much necessarily as they used to. For some reason or another, we've dummied down words or we'll do whatever. And I was thinking about a couple of examples. Our politicians, you know, they don't tell us the truth a lot of times. And I'm not too sure that a true Christian could stand up and say, okay, I believe in Jesus Christ, I'm against abortion, I'm against homosexuality, I'm against all of these other things, and be able to get elected in our world today. I mean, it's just almost impossible to think that that could actually happen. So I thought about that. And then I thought about Brian Williams. I don't listen to the mainstream news media that much. In fact, I don't listen to very much of the news media. But, you know, he was somebody that supposed to, you know, he opens his show every evening of the man that could be trusted, the voice of America, on and on and on. And he lied about his experiences. And then one of the ones that really struck me was over the past couple of weeks, the Secretary of the Veterans Administration, who is the guy that takes care of our veterans and makes sure they get all the benefits that they're supposed to get, he lied about, he said that he actually served in an Army Ranger battalion, which he didn't do. So, I mean, so there are some things to do with our words that we've dummied down. And then we sometimes overuse or misuse words. And the one that came to my mind was love. I mean, I love this. I love that. We love, love, love. And to the point that we've actually started redefining words. I don't know if you've heard over the past couple of years, the word literally has, Merriam-Webster and the Cambridge Dictionary have actually accepted a new definition or an add-on to the definition of the word literally. And it's not necessarily to be taken as literal anymore. If you want to use it to add emphasis or to express strong feelings, then that's an acceptable use of the word literally now. So I literally worked my fingers to the bone, which we've all probably used or whatever, you know. But it was, at least then, it wasn't an accepted part of the dictionary. Or, you know, this information literally turned the world upside down. So anyway, there's that. And then also, you look at social media, the way we're dumbing down our words. We don't even use full words anymore. There's like BBL for be back later, or F2F for face to face. And you can imagine when Moses is going up on Mount Sinai to talk to God, he looks around and tells them BBL, you know, and I'll be back later. And then sometimes there's implied words. I think, like, I don't know if you heard last night or this morning, but Nina Pham, the nurse from Presbyterian, you know, she stood up in front of the cameras right after her family at Presbyterian, I think that's what she called them, took care of her and helped nurse her back, support her, and now she's suing them because they didn't do everything that she thought they ought to do. So, like I say, words are not as much to us as they were. And so when I thought about that, I could see how, kind of what he meant by let's really focus on the words and how they're used in these verses. As a side note, we're talking about Moses here, and Liam was talking a while ago about being encouraged and how it is. You know, you look at Moses, he was 80 when he stood in front of Pharaoh. Aaron was 83. And then if you remember a couple of weeks ago, or maybe back in the summer, the guy from the Christian Broadcasting stood up and said that Chuck Swindoll's 80. I think Charles Stanley is 82 or 83. John MacArthur is 75. You know, in our group, those guys are very active. Moses and Aaron were extremely. And then these other guys are very active. So, I mean, there's still a lot of things to do for us in our age group. And that's one of the things when y'all heard me talk several times, and I'll probably talk a lot, and it may not ever get done. It may not be something that somebody wants us to do, but I really think that that's what our group has to offer some of the younger groups, is for them to see the experience and the wisdom that y'all have. I mean, because God forbid when we pass away, and we all will, whatever we don't pass on and leave with them, we're taking with us, and it's not here for this church to grow on. And, you know, you think about the Dr. Criswells and the ones before him that passed things on to the older groups, and it got passed on. I grew up in a smaller Baptist church, so it was easy to know the older people. You know, when I was 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, you looked across and it was Mr. So-and-so or Miss So-and-so, and they knew you, and they took an interest in your life, and you took an interest in theirs. And that's kind of why I would like to see us, if we could. I'm getting off on another rabbit trail, kind of a little personal thing. But anyway, okay, we'll get back to the lesson. In Exodus 33:19, I'm going to read that. It says, "And he said, I myself will make my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show compassion on whom I will show compassion." To me, it's the most amazing thing to see how God works. I had several things that I'm going to say about this, but one hit me out in the hallway a while ago, and he didn't even know. We got interrupted, so I didn't get to tell him. But it's like Charles said about his surgery when he had, and then Dr. Bryant when he is. And it's not that there was necessarily compassion the lack of compassion for Dr. Bryant and Ruby or Mercy, but it is God does what He wants to do, and the people that He when Charles came through, it's because God wanted him to. And when Dr. Bryant didn't, it's because God was ready for Dr. Bryant to come home. And it's not for ours to question. That's kind of what this verse says. It talks about, he says, my goodness. When God's talking about His goodness or His glory, He's referring to His divine attributes. It's the sense of the wonder of who God is, the awesomeness of it. His sovereignty. Paul's talking about God's sovereignty in Romans 9:15. And in doing so, talking about God's sovereignty, then he quotes Exodus 33, and he says, for he says to Moses, talking about God, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. The Lord's sovereignty is paramount in his dealings with any people, not just his people, not just us Christians, but all people. And he can do anything he wants to do. He doesn't have to answer to anybody, and we all know this. Some of this is elementary, and I'm just kind of restating the obvious. But he can do anything he wants to do to anybody that he wants to do, for any reason that he feels necessary. And everything that he does is sovereign and just. There's no questioning. I mean, we may question it, but there's no valid question to that. If God wasn't free to do what he wanted to do and show his mercy to who he wanted to show his mercy to and his compassion to who he wanted to show his compassion to, then nobody would get it. Nobody would get mercy and nobody would get his compassion because we can't earn it and we don't deserve it. In fact, back in Exodus 4:14, Moses had just personally benefited from God's compassion. In 4:14, the verse starts out, and I won't read the whole thing, but it says, then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. God became angry at Moses due to Moses' lack of disobedience. We're talking about God's sovereignty, we're talking about God's love, but could you imagine having God's anger burning at you? I mean, that's just an amazing statement to me, to think that God's anger is burning against me. And I'm sure they weren't aloof back in those days, but it just seemed like that they didn't. And I'm sure if it was us today, I mean, you know, you watch the Northern Kingdom and Southern Kingdom fall, and you wonder, well, why didn't they learn from their mistakes? Well, same thing could be asked of us in America. Why haven't we learned from their mistakes, you know? So, and then in Exodus 4:24-26, again, it's another dealing with Moses and God's anger. It says, now it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. This is the Lord seeking to put Moses to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And she said, you are a bridegroom of blood to me. So God left him alone. Again, Moses had made God mad because God had commanded, if we remember back in Genesis, for the Hebrews, Israelites, to be circumcised. Moses, for some reason or another, delayed, put off, maybe he was never going to do, get his son circumcised. So God was upset and his anger burned at him to the point of he was going to put him to death. Zipporah saved Moses' life. And all that had to do with Moses was disobeying God. He didn't do what God wanted him to do. He put the things that Pharaoh was going to do to him as more important or more vicious, I suppose, than what God could have done to him for not obeying him. So, and it's also important, I think, in this to know that we see God come down and talk with Moses and have a relationship with him. It's important for us to remember that when God takes these stands or when he does these things, when we have an experience with him, that it requires him, if you can say requires God of anything, but it puts him in the position of having to enter a finite sphere of space and time. I mean, he's the God that knows everything and the God that knows everywhere, and time doesn't matter at all to him. But when he comes to us, all of a sudden, time, space, and matter. Like when Jesus came to earth, before he came to earth, time didn't matter to Jesus. You know, space didn't matter to Jesus. But when he came here and became a man, time, space mattered to him. Exodus 33:20, it says, but he said, you cannot see my face, for no man can see my face and live. Face is obviously used figuratively here, and it's used to represent the complete or whole person. When we imagine somebody, if I could, you know, think of your son, daughter, grandson, whatever. When you imagine them, you imagine their face, and you can imagine that whole son, daughter, granddaughter, whatever. I mean, you can see them as a full person. But if you turn them around, look at the back of their head, and try to imagine them, you don't see very much. The first thing you try to do is turn them back around so you can imagine the whole person. That's kind of the point here is seeing the face is seeing the whole glory of God. And God's saying you can't do that. He said, so when God says, you cannot see my face, he is saying, you cannot see my full glory or all of my goodness. You can't get a complete view of that. Because Moses couldn't handle seeing God's full presence, his full glory. The power of all that was just too much for Moses to handle. In verse 33:14, which is a little bit before we read, it talks about the presence of God. And one of the commentaries said that that was the same word used there for face. Now, I didn't go look it up, so if it's wrong, it's like a J. Vernon McGee or Warren Wiersbe. Blame it on those type of guys, because that's kind of who I listened to on that. But anyway, long story longer, they used the same word for presence and face interchangeably. And so I was trying to think about things in our life that could harm us if we looked at them too long. The first thing I thought of was, I don't know if very many of you are familiar with welding. I know about it. I can't do it. But if you look at somebody welding very long, it'll burn your eyes to the point of, if you keep looking at it too long, it'll blind you. But it'll always cause problems. But one I thought that was a lot more maybe that everybody would understand would be staring directly at the sun. So I looked some of the stuff up on it. And if you stare directly at the sun for 30 seconds, they said that, as soon as you start staring directly at the sun, your eye starts to get a sunburn. Within 30 seconds, you'll have retina damage. And then with 90 seconds, most everybody will have some form of damage that cannot be overcome. It may not blind you, but you'll have eye problems from now on. So I started thinking of that, and then I got thinking, well, okay, if the sun's that, then the person that created the sun, if you look directly at him, how much more powerful is he? So how much more damaging could that be? And I think from what our verses say, that Moses would have been, basically destroyed immediately if he would have experienced God's full grace and his glory. And then Lynn, those two songs, they weren't by chance. I asked him this morning if he would sing In the Cleft of the Rock, because that's part of the verse, and then also On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand. And they come into play on this verse here, especially verse 33:21. It said, "Then the Lord said, Behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand there on the rock." Moses was going to get a guarded glimpse of God's glory. God was going to allow him to see something. And the thing that's interesting about this to me is while he was standing on the rock, which was Mount Sinai, beside God, who is his rock, he was going to get the glimpse of God. And in Deuteronomy, and I won't read the whole thing, but in Deuteronomy, starting in 32-something, it's the song of Moses. And in 32:4, it starts out, it says, "The rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are just, a God of faithfulness and without injustice, righteous and upright is he." Moses was calling God his rock in the song of Moses. And one of those side notes on that was, the rock is a symbol of God's power, and then it, as a refuge for us as frail men. And I think that's exactly what God was using there with Moses when he was allowing him to see a glimpse of his glory. He was going to let him stand on the rock and see him. And then so started thinking of examples of our rock. And that's why I asked Lynn to sing On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand, because Jesus Christ is our rock. He's the rock of the whole church. And that's who we stand. And if we're not standing on him, then everything else is sinking sand. And that was one of the things that kind of stuck out in my mind when I was reading some of this stuff. And then in Exodus 33:22, it says, "And it will come about, while my glory is passing by, that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by." And again, you see the parallel of singing in the cleft of the rock with this verse. The point is there's safety in God's presence. If he's there with us, even if he's keeping us safe from himself, so to speak, because that's what he's doing with Moses. Rather than subject Moses to the danger of seeing all of his glory, God's sovereignty realizes that you can see some, but you can't see all, and I'm going to be the one that keeps you safe. A couple examples of that is Psalms 91:1-4. It's David. He said, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For it is he who delivers you from the snare of the trapper and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions." I had to look pinions up. It's a distal or terminal wing of a bird, just so some of you, y'all may have all known that. And it says also, "And under his wings you may seek refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a bulwark." And you well know what a bulwark is, but it protects us from external danger. And that's what God was doing. He was protecting Moses from the external danger of his glory by covering his face. And then Isaiah, "I have put my words in your mouth and have covered you with the shadow of my hand to establish the heavens, to found the earth, and to say to Zion, you are my people." So again, we see God using his hand to protect his people. And then, like I said, God protected Moses with the palm of his hand. And thought maybe think of something else. And it's talked in Isaiah when God's assuring the Israelites that he will never forget them. He says, behold, I have inscribed you on the palms of my hand. And he's assuring them that, hey, you're good. I mean, no matter what, no matter what happens, and you may be here, you may be there, but I've got you inscribed on my hands. I can't forget you. And then we think of us. We think about Jesus' hands and the palm, his palms with the nail scars on there. And to a certain extent, it's like, as a believer, my name is written on Jesus' hand, but it's in the shape of a nail hole. You know, it's not written out Greg Stoy, but I'm a Christian, and because I'm a Christian, because I believe in him, those nail holes that are inscribed in his hand or pierced through his hand, they actually represent me and my sin and my ability to go to heaven because of what he's done. So I'm inscribed on Jesus' name. If he were to forget me, which God and Jesus, we all know, can't forget, but if for some reason he looks down and then there I am. So there's one thing for us to remember also. And then in Exodus 33:23, he says, then I will take my hand away, and you shall see my back, but my face you shall not see. Again, he's talking about my face. And like I said, when we're thinking about the words that Christopher, Dr. Graham wants us to remember, my face pops up a lot. My face pops up a lot. My face pops up a lot. It's always my face. You can't see it. And if you remember last week, Dr. Jeffers mentioned the word, and I'll try not to stumble over, anthropomorphic, where he said that they used to describe God, who is spirit, in terms that are familiar to us, things that we can understand. So God doesn't actually have a hand, he doesn't actually have a face, he doesn't actually have a back, because he's spirit, as it says in John 4:24. But for us to be able to understand him, we go back to him having to put himself into our realms of time and space and matter. So he has to use those things. Again, he has to come for us to be able to relate to him, for us to be able to experience him. He has to lower himself to human definitions or human words so that we can understand who he is and kind of get a glimpse of what he's talking about. And then the word pinion and wing, obviously, those are used for our benefit, for him to understand that we're under the wing. If you've seen mother ducks or birds and chickens, they'll get those wings and they'll start scooting everything together and trying to protect them, and that's kind of the view we get. So we contrast God, so we contrast between seeing God's back as opposed to seeing his face. His face obviously is his full presence, like we said before, and his back is a partial view. And the partial view is all that Moses can stand. That's all his body will allow him to hold. The point in the verse of this verse is very clear that Moses is going to get to see something. It's not going to be exactly what he wanted to see, but it's still going to be wonderful and glorious, and it's going to be all that he can handle. I mean, God's going to take him right up to the threshold of what he can handle, but he's not going to let him be harmed. Excuse me. And then, verse 34:1, we get into the part about giving the second law, and this is, to me, is pretty interesting, not that the rest of it wasn't, but it's just neat to see how God is working with Moses to reestablish the relationship of the covenant that they had beforehand. And some of the points there, as I was reading through it, some of the things that really started to jump out at me of what was actually going on when all this was happening. So anyway, Exodus 34:1, he said, now the Lord said to Moses, cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets words that were on the former tablets which you shattered. A couple of things that stick out really is, first of all, cut out for yourself. You know, it's not just cut out. It's cut out for yourself two stone tablets. And then also, like the former ones, it's mentioned twice in this one verse, like the former ones, and then like the former ones that you shattered. You know, God's pointing out to him what you've done. And like I said, this may not be anything that Dr. Graham even hits on. We may get here next week when he comes back, and none of this even makes any sense at all with what he's got going on. But these are just some of the words that actually jumped out. And I've always heard that when words are repeated, or that gives them that much more significance, that they were really supposed to focus on them. So we'll see if any of this comes about. I tried to look in the little center column of my Bible and see if any of these things were cross-referenced in John, and none of them are. Obviously, these are the second tablets. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Obviously, these are the second tablets of the law, we can tell, because when God says for you to cut out for yourself two stone tablets, and we already know that the others happened earlier.
But
Moses broke the first tablets, like we said a while ago. And he broke them as he was descending Mount Sinai. He comes down the first time, And when he gets to the bottom of the mountain, and you know this is an old story. We've learned it since we were young. But he finds the Israelites worshiping a golden calf, the very things that they're not supposed to be doing. And so here they were breaking the very commandments that God was giving Moses as he was giving them those commandments on the top of Mount Sinai. He was etching them in the stones of don't do this, don't do that. So Moses comes down, and what does he find? He finds that they have put another god before him by building the golden calf, and he finds that they've made for themselves an idol out of the gold, and Aaron's led them. So that's got to be, obviously, by the way, what Moses did with the tablets. It was very shocking and disappointing to him. Another thing I think is interesting to point out here is, again, the first stones God provided for Moses in Exodus 24:12. If you go back to read that, it says, you know, when you come up, I will have the stones, I will write on them. And he wrote on them, obviously, as we all know, with his finger, etched that stone. And then the second one, he tells Moses to bring them with him, to cut them out for yourself and bring them. He didn't say, cut them out for me to bring them up here. He says, cut them out for yourself. So those are some of the other wording that I think may become maybe important with what Dr. Graham's got going on. The command to cut out these tablets is one of the greatest demonstrations of God's mercy that a lot of the people that I read from said they've ever seen. Because it's God's way of letting Moses know that I'm going to reaffirm the covenant with you. Despite the Israelites' failure, and again, at the exact same time that these commandments were going on, that's when they were doing it. And, you know, this is one of the things that really struck me is, God knows, you know, while God was sitting there talking to Moses, I'm talking to you, and I'm not thinking about anything else but talking to you. But while God's talking to Moses and giving him those commandments, he knows what the people are at the bottom of their mountain are doing. He realizes when he says, you shall have no other gods before me, and that you shall not make for yourself an idol, God knows that they're down there, they've just made a golden calf, and they're down there worshiping it, and he's sitting there telling Moses, these are the things I don't want my people to do. So God's willing, in this thing, he's showing them that he's willing to begin again with them. And once more, he wants to instruct them concerning his righteous ways, to the ways that they need to live. He forgave them, and he restored the covenant relationship with them. In Exodus 34:2, it says, so be ready by morning, and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me on top of the mountain. Two words here, morning. And then another thing that struck me is he said, present yourself. Didn't say, come up and meet with me. Didn't come up and say, talk to me. He said, come up and present yourself to me with these two stones. 34:3, no man is to come up with you, nor let any man be seen anywhere on the mountain. Even the flocks and the herds may not graze in front of that mountain. That was meant to protect the careless and the curious, because they would die if they trespassed on holy ground. This was given to them earlier. And in light of this past week, with all the snow on the roads and whatever, one of the things that popped to me was a rubbernecker or somebody going down the road, and you see an accident, you see red lights, you see a fire engine. It's the first thing most people do, including me as a fireman, and I'm sure Jay's the same way. You think, well, they don't do that. But, I mean, it's human nature. When you're driving by, you see lights, you want to look over and see what's going on. Well, the next thing you know, you're in an accident. In fact, a funny thing happened. We had a guy Friday down by Baylor, paramedic. He was in the car. I mean, he was in the ambulance, and he wasn't. There was something else going on, and he was looking at it. And the next thing you know, he ran into the back of the car in front of him and caused a big accident. So, I mean, you know, the rubbernecking, not paying attention to what you're supposed to do. And this was what this verse was set up to do, was to protect those people from not carelessly or curiously wandering onto holy ground and having to be put to death. The instructions that were given the first time in Exodus 19:12 are still in effect in 34:3. It is so that the law can be given the second time with the same sanctity and solemnity that accompanied the first giving of the law. God doesn't, just because it's the second giving, you know, it's not like the sequel. Most movie sequels, they're not as important or they're never as good as the, I mean, there may be a few, but most movies, the original's good, the sequels are not so much. That's not how this is with the giving of the law. It's not a first run and then a sequel or a rerun. This is the exact same thing that's going on the second time. And God wants the Israelites and he wants Moses to take it as seriously now as he meant for them to take it the first time. So these things are being done to impress upon the Israelites of the awful sense of holiness of God. And by awful, it means reverential or full of awe, not a you know, the awful definition that we're usually used to. And then also, he wanted them to know that this was a matter of no small moment. This was not some trivial or insignificant event that was going to take place. This was Moses going up on holy ground and meeting God face to face again, or presenting himself to God face to face one more time to undo some of the things that had been done. And also, it's curious to note that it's hard to say that we subject God to certain things, but in a way, they subjected God to having to the necessity of redelivering the Ten Commandments because of their actions and because of Moses' actions of breaking them. They put God in the position, if he was going to renew the covenant with them, he had to go back and do something that he had already done. So that was another thing that needed to be pointed out to them, that this is not something that you need to be taking lightly, like you did the first time when you were worshiping the golden calf while I was giving the law the first time. And then the last verse, and then we'll be through a little bit early, and we'll talk about our... I wanted to talk a little bit about our outreach program some anyway, so it'll work out well. 34:4, it says, "So he cut out two stone tablets like the former ones, and Moses rose up early in the morning, and he went to Mount Sinai, as the Lord had commanded him. And he took two stone tablets in his hand." Now again, if we look, it talks about he cut out two stone tablets like the former ones, and we've heard that before. And then even at the end of this verse, he says he took the two stone tablets in his hand. And then it talks about Moses rising up early in the morning. And then we looked back earlier and God said about the morning. I think it's interesting to note, to me it was anyway, about him rising early in the morning and presenting himself to God. One of the things that popped in my mind was I thought about Abraham. And then so I looked it up, and as it turned out, it did work. But I was thinking about Abraham. And, you know, he rose early in Genesis 22:3 on the day that he was going to offer or present Isaac to God. He rose early. And so I looked at some of the other ones, and, Abraham rose early in Genesis 19:27. He rose early in the morning when he went to the place where he had stood with the Lord before. Or when he was sending Hagar and Ishmael away in 21:14, he rose early in the morning. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about rising early in the morning. There's several other ones. Obviously, Jacob rose early in the morning in Bethel, the morning after he had the ladder dream. Joshua rose early in the morning when the Israelites were going to cross over the Jordan River. And if you remember, that's when they were going to put the place of 12 stones to commemorate their crossing of the Jordan River. And Samuel rose early in the morning when he met Saul. And then Job rose early in the morning to offer burnt offerings. But to me, the most important, and to you too, and I can say this because I know, Jesus rose early in Mark 1:35. He says, "In the early morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went away to a secluded place and was praying there." To me, and I'm not as faithful as I need to be, if I don't get up early and spend time with God, or, you know, read the Bible or whatever, I can get up and I say, "Okay, I've got to go do this right quick. At 10 o'clock, I'll come back and I'll set aside time." Well, at 10 o'clock, invariably, something else, somebody will call or something will happen. If I don't get up early and do spend time with God, then I pretty much don't spend time with God that day. I mean, I may talk, you know, to him here or there, or just throw up a couple of words, and maybe as insignificant as the words I was talking about earlier at the beginning of the lesson. But we do have to spend time early in the morning, I think. Now, maybe everybody's not early morning. 9 o'clock may be early in the morning to some people. You know, I think it's your definition of early, but it's, you know, it needs to be one of the first things that you do early in the morning. And then one of the things I was reading, J. Vernon McGee, and I think this is really important to all of us right now, especially in light of what's going on in the world around us, and with what Dr. Jeffers said last week. And I've got the phone numbers. Didn't make the phone calls yet. Going to make the phone calls, and I really think we all need to. J. Vernon McGee said that God made the Israelites a peculiar people for a very definite reason. And he also said the church should be peculiar today. We are to be people for God. He said, "I don't mean we need to be oddballs." He said, his definition was, we need to be uncommon, distinctive in nature or character from others, and belonging exclusively to some person. I mean, and there's nothing any more peculiar about a Christian, if you go by those definitions, that you can think of, because we belong exclusively to one person. We should be distinct in nature and character from all of those around us. And we should be uncommon. And I think a lot of this uncommonness needs to come in when you look at those 21 Coptic Christians that were sitting down. And I mean, their heads are being cut off. And I mean, this is not just the Bible characters we see. We read about Paul and all and Peter, all of those being martyred back in those days. These are people that, if they were in America, there's a good chance, or in Dallas especially, there's a good chance they may be coming to our church. I mean, they are our brothers and sisters. And I, like I said, I've not made my phone call, and I guess I'm kind of confessing to that, but I'm ashamed of it. I mean, the very least I can do is make a phone call to my congressman. They were not going to listen to me. I pretty much realize that. But the very least, I'm not responsible for what they do or don't do. I am responsible for me not making my phone call. Especially when we have a leader, and I went back to this leader of Moses. When we have a leader like Dr. Jeffress, you know, that does take the stands that he takes. And I mean, not that New York or Fox News or any of the other places are Mount Sinai, and he's surely not meeting with God, but he goes out and he puts himself out in the world and takes a stand, and we're his flock, we're his Israelites, so to speak, and we should not be doing the golden calf thing or any semblance of the golden calf thing. When he comes back here, we need to be faithful and stand up and back him up. That a leader is only as good as his followers. I mean, because there's not a general or a colonel or fire department or businessman or whatever that would be successful if the people won't follow him. And Dr. Jeffress can't either. I mean, there's a couple of guys that go to church that are at my fire station. We'll talk about that quite regularly. They're waiting for us to fail so they can pin it on him. If he doesn't fail himself, well, what about your congregation, you know, here or there? I mean, he's got a lot of things on his plate. And to be honest, and maybe you can tell this, I'm not saying that I agree with everything that he says or does, but I don't even know everything he says or does. And I'm not following him blindly. But when Regina and I came, one of the reasons we came here, and I've shared this with Jack and Eric and a few others, and Ron, was because of Dr. Jeffress' leadership. There are a lot of guys out there that know the Bible, and maybe know the Bible. I mean, seminaries are full of guys that taught Dr. Jeffress, so they have to be pretty good too. So there are people, there's a lot of people out there that stand up and proclaim the gospel, and they do it the right way, but they're not the leaders that he is. And that's what really led us to here, was his leadership and his willingness to not only preach the gospel to us, but to stand up to the world and say, you're wrong. You know, doesn't matter if you think you're right or not, you're wrong. And you're not wrong because I'm saying it. You're wrong because God says it. So I think that we really have to be careful. And like I say, when he asks us to do those kind of things, especially if we agree with him, if you don't agree with him, don't do them. It does lead into us getting our class bigger, you know, not for the sake of getting it bigger. We don't want to have every table full just so we can say, hey, we got every table full. And one thing, let me point out, and the Sunday school lesson's over. This is more of that now. One thing I forgot when we started this thing is to ask people to pray. That was never mentioned by me when I I know Eric has mentioned it a couple of times about praying, but I never did. I mean, I was convicted of that the last couple of weeks of, we can call all we want to call, and phones are not going to get answered, and people are going to be rude. And we've had a few people that were semi-rude to some of our members that have called and asked them. And that's, to me, that's very puzzling. But it could be that maybe we're not asking the Holy Spirit to have the people that are going to receive the message be as ready to receive it as we are ready to give it to them. So, and Jack and I talked about the Holy Spirit on the phone last couple of weeks ago about how We need him, the Holy Spirit, and we need to not ignore him in this venture to make sure that he does get the people ready. Sandy, that Melba, I mean, I do think that the Holy Spirit had been working with her by what she had said. She was trying to find somewhere, and Melba hit her at the right time, and boom, it worked. And I think there's, like I say, out of 1,700 people, there have got to be a lot more Sandys and Jays and Barbies out there that want to try to find a Sunday school class. I mean, there just has to be. And like I say, I really firmly believe when they come here, they won't go anywhere else. I mean, I there's just no doubt in my mind that after they come here, they hear Dr. Graham, that's wonderful. But after they meet y'all, they won't leave. I mean, they just won't. This Patricia's helping with the trying to get the names organized, and did she get with you this week, Patricia? The reason why, she sent me an email and said she was going to get with you in secret, see if there's some way for us to weed through these 1,700 names. I don't know of any way to do it without excluding somebody in the 1,700, you know, just said, okay, this person, we're going to call. I mean, if there's no phone number, then that's fine. But I mean, even if there's an address, if some people don't want to call, we can have people sign up to send cards or, you know, just a little postcard and say, hey, we'd like for you to come. Eric and I have talked. There's a lot of people on this list that will be unable to come, probably too old, or you know, maybe they're in assisted living, or whatever. But it doesn't mean they can't still be part of our Sunday school class. I mean, they can watch it. I mean, they can listen to it. We can include them on, you know, specials. Maybe we can go by and pick them up for us. They may not come every Sunday, but we have our special things, like the one time we have the big breakfast rather than the donuts, so those kind of things. Or at least let them know that there's somebody here that cares about them there.
Amen.
And Eric and I are both extremely open to suggestions on what to do. Because like I said, this is an extremely important task. And it's huge because there's 1,700 people. And really, there's more than that. There's 1,700 here. But we need to, like Eric said, reach out past our own doors and try to find some other folks to come in and that may not know Jesus completely as their Savior. Not completely, but know Him as their Savior at all. But anyway, I'm glad that we're doing it. I'm glad that I get to do it. It's working real well. I've spent more time on this week than I did that. But Patricia, one thing was good. I was able to turn it over to her. And, I mean, she's really working hard to try to make our list a little bit better. Maybe where we can start emailing stuff back out and forth, and that way you won't have to keep up with papers and worry about sending them back or whatever. And we're open to suggestions. Like I say, if you don't mind, in fact, we're not only open for them, we would really love to have a few because it does get a little bit overwhelming at times. But, again, I want to thank y'all, and I'll be back. This is a forewarning so that you'll know this. You might have got trapped into this one. You won't have to get trapped into the next one. He's here. Dr. Grant's here next week. And then the week after he's gone and I'll be doing it then also. And he says that maybe it'll be out of 1st, 2nd, or 3rd John. That's all he would tell me. So he's going to give me whatever I need to do to come to y'all then. So thank y'all. I appreciate it. Yeah.